Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Saul Bellow. Bellow is considered one of the 20th century's greatest authors. His career lasted nearly 60 years. He won the National Book Award in three different decades. In 1953 for The Adventures of Augie March, in 1964 for his novel Herzog, and again in 1970 for Mr. Samler's Planet. In 1976, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He continued to publish critically acclaimed novels until he died in 2005, including his last, called Ravelstein. Join us now for Saul Bellow, in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures 1993-1994 season.
Thank you for your kind welcome. I haven't been in Portland since 1951, when I came by train from New York to speak at Reed College. And afterwards, I went down to Eugene. I had a wonderful time. I've missed you awfully all this while. I see also that this is a very large audience. I don't think I've ever spoken to so many people at once. I can't help thinking how well I might have done in politics if I was able to attract so many people. I don't think that this was mentioned in the introduction, but much of what I'm going to do this evening is Q&A, questions and answers. I'm going to speak from a text which I've rewritten several times and still find unsatisfactory. So instead of boring you for a full hour or so, I'm going to cut the address short. It's going to be short but pithy, I warn you. So here we go. The title of this talk is The Decline of Something or Other. An urban boyhood of the 20s surprises me in retrospect with oddities which never seemed odd at all. How should a boy of 13 with normal feelings understand that in a large historical perspective, he is in a time warp? Today, a reference to normal ideas will, in and of itself, be suspect, grounds for indictment almost. And by looking back to the 20s, I lay myself open to charges of nostalgia. Here we go again, once more. One more elderly white male is about to revisit the past and luxuriate in rotten sentiments about the good old days, from whose tyranny we are just beginning to free ourselves. I am well aware of a climate of opinion in which a dark view is taken of looking backwards. I return to the 13-year-old boy, however, with his allegedly normal feelings. To everything that life offers him, he says, "Of course." Allow me to remember then that in the Chicago of rail yards, factories, prize fights, jazz bands, this adolescent has for some years been required to read the Old Testament in Hebrew, and on his own, however, he reads Fenimore Cooper. He is well up on the gang wars, Al Capone versus Dean O'Banion. He roots for the Chicago Cubs. He idolizes the great lawyer Clarence Darrow. He has worn an Al Smith election button on his cap. He's familiar with the customs and habits of the Polish neighborhood in which he lives. He has memorized at least 50 stanzas of The Ancient Mariner and the principal speeches of Macbeth and Hamlet. He does his Latin declensions and conjugations on the streetcar en route to school. He knows a thing or two about City Hall corruption. He has read all about the shooting of Jake Lingle in the Illinois Central Tunnel, and he can tell you a thing or two about even about sex scandals involving the revivalist Amy Semple McPherson. He is aware of the picturesque preaching of Billy Sunday. He looks at the evening paper for sketches by Ben Hecht, later to be collected as 1001 Afternoons in Chicago, our own Chicago, Arabian Nights. There are almost daily items in the Chicago paper then about Carl Sandburg and Edgar Lee Masters, the city's own poets. I was, in my high school days, a member of a book-intoxicated set of boys and girls. We borrowed books, novels, histories, biographies from the public library by the armload, and we read them in a state of altered consciousness, disengaged from daily reality and the ache of limitation. We spent much of our time then in London, Paris, Petersburg, or Texas. We were present at the Sepoy Rebellion in India and at home, either in both in the House of Usher and on Captain Ahab's Pequod. Recollections of this sort are always haunted by a sort of sentimentality and attended by a sense that there was so much to run away from. Of course, ours was a commercial society, and we young readers were out of step. We felt that we were in a special minority, and that adults who worked for a living took a dim view of us. We were in rebellion against routine. We knew that hard-headed men of business, chairmen of boards, politicians, American social Darwinists, lovers of illusionless reality, etc., saw literature as a childish or adolescent business to be kept in the wetlands of fantasy. Armour, a giant among the Chicago meat packers, used to say, "All my culture is in my wife's name." The stockyards of Chicago gave the world the megatons of pork it needed, and it owned the refrigerator cars and the locomotives that carried it to both coasts. The great Armour, a remarkable person, gave his name and his dollars to an institute of technology. He wasn't about to support the humanities, while his wife took care of religion and culture. I suppose that, like all millionaire ladies in those days, she probably entertained ministers and long-haired fiddlers. The hostility or contempt or indifference of tycoon empire builders for culture has affinities today with the general indifference of even the best educated of contemporary Americans to this day. Whether artists and intellectuals have had a share in causing this indifference is a separate question. But let me go back to my account of my intoxication with literature. Not only my intoxication, but an intoxication observable in the U.S. or some quarters of it. Books, and particularly novels, were our life supports. Let me make a pitch now for the novel. More fully than any other kind of book, the novel allows us to contemplate the possibilities of life, of human passion and human emotion, the tragedy of human character, the sweetness of human spirits, or their baseness. The novel is a very special sort of privileged communication in which every reader gets the inside story. I learned long ago after I'd been a devoted reader for some years, that when you open a book, a real book, a good book, You heard a voice. You heard the voice of the person writing it. You heard not so much the words as a tone, as it were, from under the breastbone. And you were conscious of being conducted by a trusted source and led into a story. People today, while they seem more free to express themselves, actually seem more hidden from each other than ever. But it is said that they no longer have a real life story, a biography. Now, who is it that says that? Well, any number of sophisticated academics, critics, poets, writers, etc. And last week I had the privilege, if it was one, rather a strange experience of participating at Boston University in a symposium on the status and situation of literature today. And I heard myself listening, I heard other people saying that there really hadn't been any such thing as a real novel in more than half a century. It was practically something out of commission. I was there under a sort of misapprehension as a living writer who was supposed to be a fossil, and I felt very upset about it. But what is often repeated is that the last great age of individual distinction came in with Napoleon, who carried the revolution from France into the rest of Europe, that is, liberty, fraternity, equality, and a sense of unlimited opportunity for enterprising, vigorous, and ambitious young people. Napoleon created, unintentionally, a whole race of heroes, literary and otherwise, people identified in France in his day as les jeunes ambitieux, the young men of ambition. And the novel was also concerned, very much concerned, in the mid-19th century with this figure of the young man or woman, generally, of course, a man, feeling his oats and beginning to look around with a view to conquering the world one way or another. I can think of two great novels which will probably be familiar to all of you. One is The Red and the Black, whose hero, Julien Sorel, is a jeune ambitieux, a kid from nowhere who goes to the very top as fast as possible, never seems to miss an opportunity to advance himself, has a sense of exactly where he is and what to do next and how to present himself. And so from being the ill-treated and neglected child of a provincial sawmill owner, he becomes a very important young man on the make in Paris. The other ambitieux is Raskolnikov of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, a young man who feels that he has the right to commit a murder in order to advance himself, in order really to save his life as he sees it. But we are told now that there is no such thing as a real biography anymore, that human beings are lacking in this. Their lives simply don't have this kind of structure, and their personalities also are deficient in that kind of necessary distinction which creates interest in other human beings. But I have always felt myself that I waited thousands of years to be born, and I was not going to waste such a significant opportunity just because history was against me, or was said to be against me. Nor am I exceptional in that respect. It isn't for oneself that this is done, the writing of books. It is done to carry out a very great wish to assert the significance of human existence. Again and again, we are told that we are in a nihilistic age and that that significance is quickly vanishing. Well, I know very well what a record nihilism has made in this century. The millions of lives which have been devoured by nihilistic politics. It is generally argued for us also that history decides, that it tells us what we are and what we may or may not personally be. Of course, it would be extremely foolish to deny the power of the many formative forces that surround us from birth and do largely decree what we may and may not become. But it is not true to say, tell me where you come from and I'll tell you what and who you are. It's not altogether insane to answer, I waited long ages to come from darkness, and if I'm headed back into the dark, my existence now has the character of an extraordinary opportunity. And although I see your nihilism well enough, all too well, I am also a free creature. History is all very well and good, but freedom can also assert a claim to respect. We are not altogether historical creatures. There is something more. This is why I become restless when academics and intellectuals, yes, and writers too, try to tell me what is wrong with my trade, why nobody now can care about old books, old stories. The illiterate young are not the only failures. There are literate failures also. Anyway, I am not complaining or bemoaning, as a recent newspaper headline says. On the contrary, I meet persons continually who prize highly the deeper life they look for in the books they read. They know exactly what I mean. When I say that I waited thousands of years to be born, for they waited too for the miracle of incarnation. And after all, this nihilism is our creation too. It's a human creation. We made it as we make it all. We make everything, the high and the low. And now in our civilization, we believe that we have seen the high that is peculiar to it in its highest developments. And now many seem to feel that the low must have its turn. For both the high and the low are human creations, and we seem to feel it is our task to fill out the low in all its lowest possibilities. And these are our contributions then to history from the low side. Contemporary man seems to have grasped that he is called upon to complete the entire span and to finish the story of this civilization and its defeat and degradation. So let me go back for a moment now to the young man reading those books in Chicago back in the late 20s and early 30s. Dos Passos, Faulkner, Hemingway, Dreiser were the novelists for whose new books we saved our nickels. You earned a dollar a day during the Depression if you were lucky enough to get a Saturday job. Two full days in the cellar of a Woolworth's stockroom shop paid for my copy of The 42nd Parallel by John Dos Passos, and I didn't feel it a sacrifice, a piece of luck rather. It was a privilege to know that even the characters themselves, what even the characters themselves in a novel didn't know. You saw them from within. You experienced with them, revealed as no journalist or historian could reveal them. You had a secret and intimate knowledge of their private ways. I'm going to jump now to we'll leave out most of the lecture that I prepared and go on to speak about something which I consider to be very important relating to what I have, to the notions I developed just now. When I was young, artists were identified with intellectuals. That they should have been drawn together, the artists and the intellectuals, was quite natural. our most respected seniors were ideologists and heavy thinkers, Marxists, many of them, or Nietzscheans. The universities encourage this association of art and intellect. Junior professors rebelling against the academic establishment fought the old fogies with Marxist ideas or with fiery Nietzschean analyses. We followed in the footsteps of, of Malraux, Brecht, Salonet, and Thomas Mann. Few writers had escaped the influence of Marx, Freud, and Bergson, and the leaders of historical thought. They were overshadowed by evolutionist or historicist tendencies, by the powerful German intellectuals of the Weimar Republic of the 20s, the sociologists, the philosophers, the anthropologists, the students of myth. These, we thought, could be trusted to provide an orientation for future novelists, painters, poets, dramatists, and culture historians. And you couldn't blame young Englishmen, Italians, Spaniards, Frenchmen, or Americans for seeking intellectual guidance. They needed a dependable description of the modern age. They wanted firm ground under their feet and direction. And they did no differently, really, from their great predecessors of the 19th century, whose teachers had been Rousseau, the German philosophers, the French biologists, etc. Tolstoy had been an acknowledged Rousseauan. Dostoevsky fought to defend Russia from French intellectual infection. The ideal of young novelists in my time was to combine intellect with fiction in powerful books. No one, of course, could succeed in doing this, though many took on the impossible challenge of dual mastery of both intellect and art. This effort deserves honorable mention, but it was, of course, a mistake. It was a waste of youthful spirit and strength, and a misunderstanding from first to last. You needed a rare soundness of instinct to avoid such a mistake. Writers do, of course, have the capacity to be intellectual. It's not the brain power that they lack. What many a novelist failed to see was the damage and the danger of being an intellectual. Here is my argument as concise as I can make it. The greatest mental achievement of modern times is the achievement of science. Together with commercial society, science has transformed the world. The counterpart of the scientist in the social scheme is economic man, seen by the world of culture today as bourgeois and philistine. I'm not going to clutter my presentation with historical details already quite well understood. I will move directly to the main point. The main point is that modern science assumes that nature, the object of its inquiry, is soulless and that it is not informed by mind. Art balks at this. The artist is apt to feel that the soullessness of nature is a helpful or useful premise for science, but not necessarily a provable one. For science, beauty does not exist in nature. Culture, like morality, like love, cannot be recognized as anything but a wish and assertion. There is an anecdote about two French mathematicians who have just seen a performance of Racine's Phaedra, and as they come out of the theater, one mathematician says to the other, "Qu'est-ce que cela prouve?" meaning, "What does this prove?" Art proves nothing. The arts have no ground in modern thought as we see it under the control of the sciences. Under the best system of proof, the arts prove nothing. What I'm driving at is that intellectuals have made no real effort to discover an independent foundation for the arts apart from science. This is where art and intellect must part company. The intellectuals have gone with the winners. one important form of seriousness, the seriousness and reality of art, has become a chapter in history without contemporary status. And many intellectuals, notably a group of professors of literature, insist on examining the premises of the arts and, to an extent, of the sciences too, from a critical historical standpoint, as products of our own patriarchal history, our imperialism, our colonialism, our sexist civilization, and all of this hopelessly misleading, corrupt, hypocritical, and base. Literature is merely an embarrassment to these professional specialists. But the generally unspoken premise of the novelist is that there is much about human existence which is not explained by victorious science. It simply does not describe human creatures as we are. Too much is left out.
You're listening to a talk by Saul Bellow. He spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 1994. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
A recent writer has referred to novelists as phenomenologists, and phenomenology, which I looked up in the dictionary, is defined as the study of the development of human consciousness and self-awareness. Webster adds to this, human consciousness and self-awareness in abstraction from any claims concerning existence. I think I can buy that. This will at first sound formidably theoretical. In fact, it is very simple. It is the least theoretical of notions. It is really pre-theoretical. All it says is that any plain account of an action tells you about human beings as they are viewed by you and me without any theoretical assumptions at all. Nothing could be simpler than this. Let me give a specific example drawn from a book I mentioned earlier, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. In that book, an impoverished young man plans to kill an elderly moneylender, a useless and wicked person from his point of view. For this purpose, he borrows or appropriates an axe. Since he can't carry the axe through the street, he sews a loop inside his coat to hang the axe from. Now, as we watch this young man busy with thread and needle, what is it that we feel? It is fair to say that we are horrified. Now, of course, Dostoevsky was a Christian, and he communicates to us a religious horror in the face of such a crime. He inclines us also to feel what he is feeling. On the other hand, he seems to understand quite well what others who may not share his religious objection to a murder will feel about this bit of sewing. He takes it for granted that they too will be horrified. Suppose we accept the scientific premise that nature is soulless, and that man, considered as a creature and as a part of the natural world, has no such thing as a soul. Well, theories about souls or soullessness are beside the point in a case like this. What counts is the response elicited from us before we have consulted our theoretical beliefs or preferences. We become aware, in the case of Raskolnikov, or in the case of Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, that we respond from a moral impulse or a moral intuition to which we have never given much thought. And we have, moreover, no responsibility to explain scientifically what is there. Such responsibilities are the problems of a scientist or a philosopher of science. The scientist gets extraordinary results by postulating a soulless nature. But there is no reason why writers, that is, novelists, poets, dramatists, should accept the same postulate. They are within their rights in refusing to be satisfied with such a disenchanted account of man. Their only responsibility is to show us what they see and how they feel about what they see. In so doing, they carry us with them. There is really nothing here to be theoretical about. Well, I doubt whether I shall be able to wind such an abstruse subject up once and for all. We, mankind, are a slippery subject, too. The only possible conclusion is that we are in the presence of a mystery when we look at the world through the eyes of art, a radical mystery at that, and that we are nowhere near a comprehensive description. It's all very provoking. Thank you. Now, I'm supposed to be handed some questions now.
Excuse me. If you'll pass your questions forward, I'll collect them.
I wish I could tap dance while these things were being gathered up. Question, do you ever reread your books? If so, what do you find? Well, there's no need for me to reread my books. I think about them sometimes, and I even look into them. Occasionally, I'm in a position to congratulate myself. More often, I can't see how I could possibly have made so many mistakes on a single page. We heard that you had something to do with the starting of Powell's books. Is this true? Well, Powell's books is entirely the product of Mr. Powell's intelligence and enterprise. What is true is that in Chicago many years ago, some of us wanted a bookstore on 57th Street near the university, and we found a location and interested Mr. Powell in opening a business there. We were helpful to him, too. I mean, we put up some money, but he paid back every penny. Do you miss Hyde Park? How do you like living in Boston? I've recently moved from Chicago to Boston. Well, I gave Hyde Park the best years of my life, as we say. Now when I walk up and down the streets, I have a melancholy feeling of missing persons in various houses that I pass in the street. I remember who lived here once and who lived there, and what happened to her, what happened to him. It's not entirely cheerful. I like to walk where I don't know what happened behind the windows. Now, I know that Boston is an old town. Lots of people have died in those houses, but I didn't know any of them. People like to blame the ills of American society on the loss of neighborhoods, communities, etc. Do you agree? Well, I don't know how much I can agree. Something seems to be happening to the United States that most people don't really understand. I least of all understand those things. A household used to be a family with a father and mother, and sisters and brothers, and friends and relatives. And now it's a sort of corridor to the TV set. And people take turns listening or watching the TV or joining a couch potato parent for a while. But that's not the same, really. There's less dinner table conversation. Yes, of course, it's too bad that the neighborhoods had to break up, but it was bound to happen eventually. They were jerry-built to begin with. They were temporary accommodations, mostly for immigrants. And when the immigrants improved their condition, they moved out. Of course, I'm sorry to see communities go. Who wouldn't be? As a young boy in Chicago, did you embrace Americanization or rejected it? I embraced it. I was very enthusiastic about it. I have not lost my enthusiasm for it. I agree with Winston Churchill that it's is the worst system of government except for all the others. Question. Public education seems to be losing respect and the support it needs to provide a unifying experience for our young people. Do you have any concern for the state of undergraduate education, especially liberal arts? Well, I don't think there is much education nowadays. There are billions of dollars being spent, and under new legislation there'll be millions more spent. The teachers don't seem to know what they're teaching, nor do they care very much, evidently. They teach only what they themselves have learned in colleges of education. That is, to encourage socialization, attitudes of equality, et cetera, et cetera. All of these wonderful things which we learned about in the streets when I was young. Not always peacefully, but with fist fights. However, we didn't knife or shoot one another. That was unknown until the modern age, which with its improved system of education seems to have set the stage for it. It's a great pity to see all of these, to see so much neglect and so much illiteracy and functional illiteracy, but let's not start on that. I'm not here to give you an edifying lecture. You hear that from other speakers. Any more questions? I've only got one clutch of them here. Oh boy. What living writers would you propose for the Nobel Prize? Well, it's easy for me to say that I don't take the Nobel Prize too seriously. I was asked in 1976 whether I thought I deserved it, and I said, well, I deserved it less than some and more than others. And looking over the field, I felt that the Nobel Prize Committee had, after all, done the right thing. Of course, there's a great to-do about it. My one regret about the Nobel Prize is that it was not being well managed financially in those days. So since the prizes are based on the interest earned by the endowment, my complaint is that we got much less money than they're getting today. However, the lawyers got it all from me anyhow, and nothing was left. And what happens after you receive the prize is that you're expected to be now an honored senior functionary, unpaid functionary, to advance culture and enlightenment in the United States and elsewhere. I don't really feel like that, really. Especially the unpaid part. What living writers would I propose for the Nobel Prize? Well, there are quite a few around whom I would strongly recommend. The trouble is that the good ones keep dying. I would have recommended Ralph Ellison, who died last Friday. No doubt about it, I think he should have had the prize. There are a certain number of writers in Eastern Europe about whom I feel quite strongly that they might have had the prize. Sometimes I think the Nobel Committee acts too much as a sort of international peacemaker, trying to do the right thing by various, well, not always on the basis of merit, let's put it that way. I don't want to get into this. Were you aware of the stalking? This refers to an article in the New York Times Magazine of a few weeks ago in which the writer tells us, and I was not aware of it, that he stalked me around Hyde Park in Chicago for many months. And all I could feel was no tribute to my powers of observation because... I didn't know it was happening. It really doesn't speak well for my... He also said that I noticed everything and that he could see me in the act of rapacious noticing everywhere I went. But I didn't notice him. Also, being a naturally democratic, my office door at the university was always wide open, and all comers were given a friendly greeting until I found out what they were after. Can the Cubs overcome the slow start? Not the Cubs. In my time, I was a Cubs fan for excellent reason, because they had Guy Bush, Kai Kyler, Woody English, Gabby Hartnett. They had a marvelous team. It was a pleasure to go to Wrigley Field, but now it's just it's fairly boring. Who are the writers you read, especially any women? Well, I read a great many women. I read Jane Austen. I read George Eliot. I read Christina Stead. Do you know Christina Stead? Any of you? She's a wonderful Australian writer, absolutely marvelous writer, the author of a good many books, one about international banking called The House of All Nations. And I especially recommend one called The Little Hotel. Let's see. As soon as I begin to try to think of whom I read, my mind goes blank. Well, I read Flannery O'Connor with great admiration. I think she's a wonderful writer. About 30 years ago, you wrote an article in the Times Book Review, "Deep readers of the world, beware. True symbolism is substantial, not accidental. Don't approach it from cultural idolatry," and so on, for several hundred words. Do you still feel the same? No, I don't feel the same. It was just a phase or a fit of critics to see great significance in matters that didn't really call for that sort of interpretation. For instance, you can get on a bus without referring to the Risa motif, the journey travel theme. And so on. If you go down to the basement, you're not necessarily visiting Dante's Inferno, and so forth. And this is what I was complaining about, because there's a great deal of it going on just then. And I was just about to publish Henderson the Rain King, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I one-upped everybody? And because the novel was set in Africa, with two primitive tribes, whom I had totally invented myself. I'd lead all these people away from a symbolist interpretation of my book, but it didn't work that way. They still reviewed me badly. Did your early years in Quebec have an effect on your writing? Do you have any ties to Canada? Well, yes, my early years in Quebec did have a tremendous effect on me. I remember them very vividly, very, very minutely. I remember Armistice Day of 1918. We were standing on the front steps. I was about 2 years old, and suddenly there was a great noise, and people were shouting, "Armistice, armistice." It's my first contact with world history. It was also very charming to live in Canada in a very mixed part of Montreal, where we had Russians, Poles, Ukrainians, Scotsmen. There was a Scotch regiment in the neighborhood that paraded with bagpipes and kilts. It made had a great effect on me, and also the number of languages spoken there, and our street was just a few blocks away from the waterfront, and you saw all sorts of picturesque characters and some marvelous drunks and some terrific fistfights. respond to the Oregonian's observation that you are not a politically correct writer. Well, I'm glad they put it so mildly. No, I'm not a politically correct anything. But I think that this is something that, although I'd like to treat it lightly, deserves a real comment. I've never seen anything so close to Stalinism as I see today. I grew up in the 30s and I saw a lot of it then. I think that that following the party line has become a huge collective mania of an almost hysterical nature. I think that people are not speaking their own opinions at all. They're only repeating what they think is most suitable for them in their station of life, and that they don't want any disagreeable problems with other people, and that therefore they don't like to step out of line. There's also a certain pleasure in chasing and stoning people who disagree with you instead of holding discussions with them. The essence of democracy and the foundation of free speech is not just a few sentences in the Constitution. It has to do with debate. It has to do with the power to answer, and inquire and answer, and to reply. And in the present mood of the country, dominated by what we call political correctness, this open discussion, free discussion, is practically under a ban because you're immediately called a bad name. And people go around decorated by their opinions, especially if they're doing all right. They want all right opinions to hold, and so they hold them quite strongly. And it's always nice to have a minority to despise, or perhaps another majority. Nobody knows, because people are not free to express their views. There's certain topics that are absolutely taboo these days, and you can't open your mouth about them without being trashed. How do you develop plots for your novels? Do characters come first? Well, it all happens in very strange ways. Somebody asked me this question recently. They asked me about a character in a short novel called The Bella Rosa Connection. How did I happen to write about him? Well, I heard an anecdote at a dinner table about a man who had been arrested in Italy in 1938. He was a foreigner. Under the Nuremberg laws, the anti-Semitic laws, he was locked up. And he was rescued from jail and brought to America by an underground organization led and financed by Billy Rose, the Broadway impresario. This struck me as an extremely strange thing. Of course, I had heard about Billy Rose. Who could help it? He was such an effective self-publicist. And also, he had had such a curious, glamorous, and seedy life. I remember reading his columns in the New York papers. I also remember meeting him in Jerusalem at the King David Hotel when he came over with a Japanese sculptor, whose name slips me, to start a sculpture garden. And Billy had lost the El Al had lost, the airline had lost Billy's luggage. And Billy was in a fury in the lobby of the King George Hotel, demanding that they track down his missing bags and the suits and the shirts and the shoes and the neckties. And so this was my only impression of Billy Rose. The rest all came out of my own teeming intelligence. It simply clicked. Something comes together and sets you off. You never really know what it's going to be, but you discover that you have somewhere at the back of your mind all kinds of strange connections, and you wait for the blessed moment when they all connect. Henry James once wrote about a writer of his acquaintance coming down the stairs of an apartment house in Paris and seeing the family at evening prayer before dinner, and this was all she needed, he said, to write a very stirring book on the subject of this family about which he knew nothing at all. So one never knows what's cooking or where it's all coming from. All you know is that you're grateful when it happens.
That was Saul Bellow speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1994. Bellow is hailed as one of the greatest American writers of the 20th century and won the 1976 Nobel Prize for Literature. His talk was from Portland Arts and Lectures in 1993-1994. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Remen produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.